office.
Routes complete, Keystream 5.
13:20:31.
Time of handover.
13:20:34.
OK, good copy received. XO, my half authenticate, sir.
Wio, my half authenticate, sir.
The message authenticates correctly. XO, bring the submarine to action stations.
The sounds you've just heard were an exercise, a run-through of the first part of the nuclear missile firing sequence aboard the Trident submarine HMS Vanguard before it sailed from Faz Lane as the Christmas patrol. There's always one Trident boat out there, moving deep through the North Atlantic at a fast walking pace, huge, silent, and undetectable, with more destructive power on board than all the explosives used everywhere in World War II from beginning to end. This programme is not about the pros or cons of a British nuclear capability, it's about the human factor. When a country decides to become a nuclear power, it needs to create a human button to command, control and operate its retaliation system. The British human button consists of prime ministers, alternate decision takers in the cabinet lest he or she is wiped out by a surprise attack, policy and military advisers, and the men, so far they've always been men, in the RAF bombers and later the Royal Navy submarines, charged with delivering the weapon.
Ship control, pipe the submarine to action stations, missile for strategic launch.
Action stations, missile for strategic launch.
Full rise on the four planes, two up, stop engine.
Stop engine.
One up, two up achieved.
Very good.
Level bubble.
50
metres. Very good. Slow stern, revolutions 20.
Slow stern, revolutions 20.
How does the firing chain work? For this programme, we've been given greater access to its mechanisms than ever before. Is it fail-safe, even if a Prime Minister loses his or her marbles? Is there a special kind of anthropology, a state of mind, among the airmen and sailors who've spent the bulk of their working lives preparing to do it? And what's it really like to have your finger on the nuclear button?
I held, particularly as a young Vulcan captain, huge responsibilities. When I look back on it, I tremble at the responsibilities I held. I signed for my first nuclear weapon when I was 23 years old. When I think about it, it staggers me now. In a way, where I suppose we were automatons. We weren't encouraged to do too much philosophical thinking about it. No, the philosophy was this deterrent thing. If we do this properly, we won't have to do it. And we took great comfort from that.
Nigel Baldwin, a former Vulcan bomber pilot. Just one Vulcan is still flying. The swept delta-wing bomber is the machine which most visibly and readily conjures up the anxious years of the High Cold War. Inside its cramped cockpit on a shining autumn morning at RAF Bryce Norton, I met Robin Wolven, whose World War III task in the 1960s would have been to guide his Vulcan low across the Russian tundra to 35 miles short of Murmansk before deploying its blue steel nuclear missile against the headquarters of the Soviet Northern Fleet. What would they have talked about on the way to the target?
I'm not sure there would be much loose chat, but there was a continual verbal and non-verbal communication between the three of us in the back here, and someone once described it, it's like sitting in a darkened cupboard flying backwards.
If you were at home and the alert happened, tell me about that.
There was a cascade system of telephone calls, and when the telephone rang, you had a certain number of things to do, most important of which was to make sure that you got yourself into the station through the main gate, parking, straight into operations. You will be hearing bomber controller on the tannoy.
Attention, attention. This is the bomber controller for bomb listed data. Scramble. Authentication. Whiskey 9 Juliet. ER 10000.
When I hear the cadence of the bomber controller's messages, it still gives goose pimples and makes the hair on the back of my neck and my legs stand up.
Roy Brocklebank, whose hairs still rise at the sound of that message, was in charge of the vault at RAF Scampton, the Vulcan base just north of Lincoln, where the ultra-secret targeting plans were kept, ready to be placed one per aircraft in the so-called go bag carried by the navigator. There were always V-bombers on alert throughout the 60s. Once their engine started, they could be airborne in under 2 minutes. Soviet missiles could be falling on their bases as the RAF bombers climbed high and fast towards the North Sea, to the point of no return, known as the Start Line, roughly speaking between Norway and Denmark. Roy Brocklebank recalls the permanent tension their training induced.
One Saturday we were on a quick reaction alert at Cottesmore, about 10 in the morning, and the wives came down with some cakes for coffee and so on. And at the very moment the wives appeared in the doorway, the tannoy clicked. Without waiting to hear what the message was, everybody was on their feet, running past their wives, nobody said anything, out of the door into the cars, and the crew on the other side of the hangar also rushing out into their car down the peritrack towards the aircraft.
This very understated matter-of-factness is very much a part of the social anthropology of the military component of the human button, whether they be airmen or submariners, though they know better than anyone what a thermonuclear explosion would do. Their wives knew a good deal too. Theresa Brooks's husband, Andrew, was a Vulcan pilot in the late 1960s and 70s.
I can remember my husband saying on a number of occasions, you just bundle the children and some blankets and warm clothes and don't hang around, don't think about it, just head for the Pennines, it's your best chance.
Did you think about what might happen to Andrew, your husband?
Well, clearly, we all knew, the one thing we did know was there wasn't going to be enough fuel to come back. So his captain said, just keep flying east, young man, and hope to settle down with a nice warm Mongolian woman.
Sitting in the surviving Vulcan shortly before it took off, it all came back to Robin Wolven.
Certainly on regular exercises, as one drove out to the quick reaction alert aircraft on the operational readiness platforms, you passed the married quarters, and in the daytime you could see the children in the primary school playground. And obviously they didn't have shelters to go to. They were going to suffer if the Russians targeted our airfields, as I understand they were.
All of them were going to die.
They would die if the deterrent failed. And our job was to make sure that our bit of the deterrent didn't fail.
The Vulcan's at the end of the runway at Bryce Norton. Squadron leader Martin Withers will be shortly bringing up to maximum power, and then it will begin to roll down this huge, long airstrip. And here he is, he's coming up to maximum power now. He's beginning to roll. And now you can pick up the sound, the extraordinary sound of those engines. If it was for real, had been for real, there would have been twice this level of sound, because two would go off together. And here it comes. He's beginning to rotate, he's airborne. There he goes.
The Vulcan, inevitably, is an attention-seeking aircraft, but the system of bunkers from which the government would operate if war came was intended to be kept deeply secret. Perhaps the most sensitive bunker of all, certainly at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, was under the Cotswolds in Wiltshire. It's now looked after by Andy Quinn.
Hello, sir. Welcome to the underground facility at Corsham. The entrance we're going into is, in fact, a military facility which is still operational, but from there we will gain entrance into the nuclear bunker itself. If you'd like to come in.
Here we are. Into the little vestibule, and here's the lift.
Oh my God.
Yes. After a short walk, we come through a door which is almost like a tale of Narnia. You walk through that door into this extraordinary old limestone quarry, this Bath Stone working. And the first thing you see on the wall is a graffito, stuck here for eternity. And I have with me Peter Hudson, who was a long-serving Air Ministry and Ministry of Defence official, and during a spell in the Cabinet Office in the late 60s and early 70s, was one of the small group of people who, A, knew about this place, and B, had a responsibility for it in terms of briefing ministers. And also David Young is with me, who, in one early job, was private secretary to the Chief of the Air Staff, but in the early 70s in the Ministry of Defence was on their nuclear side, Defence Secretariat 12, if I remember. Peter Hudson, you were one of the very few people who knew in advance about all of this. I mean, what was it like when you had to contemplate leaving your family?
I remember having retrospective black thoughts about what on earth would I do if it really happened. And then I thought, well, I've nearly finished my tour in this job anyway, and perhaps I'll be lucky.
Tell me about the Black Thoughts. What did you think?
Well, what would you do with your leaving your family like that? I really wasn't at all sure whether I didn't rather hope the balloon went up before I got to this stage, but I resolutely refused to think of the parting from one's family in those situations.
And of course you couldn't talk to your wife or anybody else about it, could you?
No, I didn't. Just bottled it. And it was not agreeable, and I tried to think of it as very much an academic problem affecting some other person.
Just going through a double-locked steel door in the old mine working on this remarkable truck. And above you can see the limestone ceiling of the old quarry. And very typical of this installation, there's yellow bricks on either side where it's been bricked up, and rooms off on either side. Now I'm going down quite a steepish little slope. And West Main Road we're going into now, and they've got street names, the bigger of these corridors through the old mine. Now into South Main Road. The people who'd come down in advance on the trains from Olympia Station in great secrecy to Warminster, where they were being fed and watered at the army base, and brought up here quietly in army trucks, they would have come down these corridors. This is the first experience they would have had of this extraordinary world in which they were going to have to live and survive if the worst happened, through unimaginable ghastliness of a kind the world had never seen before and mercifully never was to see. And it's hard to even begin to reconstruct the thoughts that they might have had as they came down these corridors. The trucks have now stopped by a little door in the brick wall, and we're just passing through. Now it is door number, if I can see it, 14-5. This is area 14, which is very much the inner core where the Prime Minister and the Chiefs of Staff and their advisers and the intelligence people would have been located if it had happened. And we're walking through a brick and a breeze block corridor, quite narrow, with large chunks of the quarry limestone wall sticking out in the gaps, into the map room. In here, or perhaps from that viewing area up there, just where the glass panel is where the Prime Minister and the relevant small group of ministers would have taken the retaliation decision if they'd got here in time and they were certain that Soviet missiles or bombers were on the way. David, let's imagine it's the last week of October 1962. Mr. Khrushchev has not backed down on the Sunday lunchtime. And it's happened. And I'm the Prime Minister, I'm Mr. Macmillan, and we've got to decide what to do. We've only got a few minutes. And I say, what do we do?
I say we failed. It is absolutely pointless to retaliate. Keep your nuclear arsenal. Hope that it might be a bargaining chip with somebody. If need be, put them under the command of the Australians, who are going to be in a better position now to make a fist of it than we are. It's tragic, but it's pointless to retaliate.
By the late 1960s, when MI5 were pretty sure the Russians had rumbled Corsham, the system was adapted to enable the Prime Minister and his World War III war cabinet to go to any number of bunkers. Corsham, an underground city with space for a 4,000-strong mini Whitehall, was kept on as a deception, and the Soviet satellites continued to pass over it. It was in No. 10 Downing Street, in the last days of peace, and down in the bunkers in the last hours, that the two strands of deterrence, the policy and operational sides, would come together. It fell to Sir Michael Quinlan, whose final job in Whitehall was permanent secretary to the Ministry of Defence, to brief three successive prime ministers, Callaghan, Thatcher and Major, and to explain what he saw as the paradox of deterrence.
On the one hand, you make it as likely as possible that if they drive you to it, you will really do it. But precisely by doing that, you are trying to maximise the unlikelihood that you'll ever be driven to it, that the other side will ever dare to provoke you enough. And on the whole, the ops people were on the first half of that paradox, that is, making it entirely credible that we had thought through and we would do it if we were driven to it. And on the other hand, the policy people were in the deterrence business, trying to maximise the likelihood that we would never be so driven.
You briefed in different ways three prime ministers on deterrence theory. Can you recall for me what it was like to have to brief a prime minister on this?
The thing that struck me was the colossal seriousness with which they all took it. I think they were all aware, behind the high theory stuff, that this was in the end about, would you, if you had to, press buttons? What do you write in the letter?
The letter? Early in a new prime minister's tenure, the cabinet secretary briefs him or her on the choices to be made from beyond the grave. Since Ted Heath's time, when the deterrent was already deep underwater in the Polaris submarines, each prime minister has written longhand four signed documents, one for a safe on each boat, containing their decision on whether to retaliate or not if Britain is already a smoking, irradiated ruin and they're dead. They're called the last resort letters, and it's a system peculiar to the British and emulated by no other nuclear nation. As far as we know, there are about four options. Retaliate, don't retaliate, submarine commander to use his own judgment, put yourself under US or Australian command if possible. But before that chilling session with the cabinet secretary, a new prime minister is briefed on what the system can do by the chief of the defence staff. This was Lord Guthrie's task when Tony Blair became PM in 1997.
I explained to him how the system worked and how the boats were deployed and how we had one at sea and we were ready, and that was part of our deterrent. I think, quite honestly, like most prime ministers, he hadn't given a huge amount of thought to what this really meant. And it is actually an awesome responsibility. It really comes home to you that he could, if the circumstances demanded it, create devastation on a huge scale.
How did he react?
Well, I think he was quite quiet when he actually heard what was at the country's disposal.
On one level, on an absolute level, there's no decision they take, whatever faces them after that, that matches this one in its awesomeness and its singularity.
I'm sure that's right. I think people have to forget what huge responsibilities they have in this field.
During the Cold War, from 1961 until the end, two alternate decision-takers were indoctrinated into this grim world. They were chosen personally by the Prime Minister. Since 9/11, the alternate system has been restored. When Labour returned to power in the mid-1960s, Dennis Healey, then Defence Secretary, was appointed one of the alternates by Harold Wilson. Lord Healey's job in the last hours of peace was to go to the RAF Bomber Command bunker beneath the Chilterns at High Wycombe. Did the responsibility burden him?
I did feel rather worried about it in a way, because I knew it would be a very difficult decision to take. And in fact, later on, when I did an exercise on theoretical decision, I realised I would find it very, very difficult indeed to agree to use a nuclear weapon. And I think most people would, because you knew if you decided to use a nuclear weapon, your family might be dead within half an hour.
What did you decide in your own mind to do?
You had to make them think you would use them, even if you wouldn't in practice.
So, are you telling me that you would have used them to keep deterrence going, as it were, or are you telling me you really would have retaliated?
I think in practice I would not.
If it had really happened and deterrence had failed and you were in the bunker under the Chilterns,
yes,
you would have thought, deterrence has failed, I'm not going to kill 20 million Russians.
Yes, I think so, yes.
Let's assume that had happened for real, and in a period of international tension, in the last day or so of peace, you'd gone down to the bunker, and you said to the head of Bomber Command what you've just said to me, that deterrence has failed, I'm not going to be responsible for killing 20 million Russians. And the head of Bomber Command says, but Secretary of State, just think, they will have us cost-free. Are you sure, are you absolutely sure that retaliation isn't what we've got to do? What would you have said to the head of Bomber Command?
I would think I would still have said that that is, I'm afraid, no reason for doing something like that, because most of the people you kill will be innocent civilians.
Under the British system, unlike the American, wives and families of decision takers didn't go into the bunkers. You'd have had to leave Edna and the children above ground. You knew that, didn't you?
Oh, of course you did, but you also knew they'd be dead.
Did you ever talk to Edna about this?
I never discussed the unpleasant and difficult things with Edna because there's no point in making two people unhappy instead of one, especially if you love them.
Did she ever ask you about it?
No, she didn't. She's not daft.
Unless politicians like Lord Healy tell us their decision, history will never find out, because nobody knows what's in the Prime Minister's letters of last resort, and they're destroyed unread by the Cabinet Office when the Premiership changes. Only one Prime Minister has said on the record what their decision would have been, and that's the late Jim Callaghan talking to me in 1988.
If that had become, as you say, necessary and vital, it would have meant that the deterrent had failed, because the value of the nuclear weapon is, frankly, only as a deterrent. But if we had got to that point where it was, I felt it was necessary to do it, then I would have done it. I've had terrible doubts, of course, about this, and I say to you that if I had lived after having pressed that button, I could never, never have forgiven myself.
Jim Callaghan was no Dr. Strangelove. But what happens if a Prime Minister, under immense and growing stress, loses it and authorises a nuclear release for which, in the minds of his advisers, there is no justification? Under the British constitutional system, which abhors writing things down, it's never been made plain until now. So, what if a Prime Minister goes bananas? Lord Guthrie.
I think the Chief of Defence Staff, if he really did think the Prime Minister had gone mad, would make quite sure that that order was not obeyed. And I think you have to remember that, actually, Prime Ministers, they give direction, they tell the Chief of Defence Staff what they want, but it's not Prime Ministers who actually tell a sailor to press a button in the middle of the Atlantic. The armed forces are loyal. We live in a democracy. But actually, their ultimate authority is the Queen.
So, under our constitution, the Queen is the head of the armed forces, not the Prime Minister.
That's correct.
And the Prime Minister cannot give a military order. Only a military person can give a military order.
The Prime Minister couldn't directly deal with a boat which was at sea.
And if it had fallen to you, heaven forbid, in these circumstances, you would not have passed the order down the line through the Norfolk bunker to the boat.
Well, I think that's a hypothetical question. But if I thought the Prime Minister was mad, of course I wouldn't.
Presumably, the Prime Minister can sack the Chief of the Defence Staff in these circumstances, but only the Queen can appoint a new one, which gives the system, if you can call it that, time to bring in the white coats.
You could say that. The Prime Minister can certainly sack the Chief of Defence Staff, and he might find a more pliable one, I suppose. But these things can't happen terribly quickly, and I suspect during the time when he was hunting around for a new Chief of Defence Staff, common sense would prevail.
It's one thing for a Chief of the Defence Staff to intervene, but what if a properly authorised instruction is issued and an airman or a sailor down the firing chain can't bring themselves to kill millions? Since 1969, the primary deterrent role has been taken by the Royal Navy. Toby Elliott commanded the Polaris submarine HMS Resolution during the Cold War. Did he ever come across anyone whom he suspected wouldn't do it?
I knew several of my colleagues who went through the commanding officers course and who were then selected to command Polaris submarines who said they couldn't do it, and they were very brave to do so. Two of them went on to have very distinguished naval careers in submarines in command of fleet boats, and their view was respected. In other cases, they lost their sea-going appointment and effectively ended their naval careers.
You say there were several of them over the years?
Yes. Several being more than two, but not many.
The ones who lost their sea-going careers, was it because of that or because there was a shortage of boats for them to captain?
No, it was because they turned down the opportunity to, or the invitation to command a Polaris submarine, and because they had doubts about their ability to carry out the ultimate act.
It must affect families too. The question of whether husband or dad would do it. Jennifer Baldwin, wife of Nigel, from whom we heard earlier. Did they ever discuss it?
No, we didn't, because even if he had felt that it was
perhaps something really and truly he couldn't do, he wouldn't be able to say that to anyone. So no, we didn't talk about what it, you know, whether he would actually be able to do it. I'm sure there would have been people who perhaps couldn't. We were very young at the time, and I mean, I would be thinking much more deeply about it now, if this is all going on now. But when you're, you know, 23, you tend not to.
The nearest any submariner has come to the real thing is test launching a missile off Florida's Cape Canaveral. Toby Elliott has never forgotten what that was like.
You have on board the American shakedown people who help with the training of the, particularly the missile men and so on and so forth. And they all go around when you hear that the launches have been successful and the warhead has arrived spot on downrange. And they all go around with cigars and, you know, clapping everyone on the back and cheering and all the rest of it. And I remember to this day sitting there, and we all sat there and we were rather stunned. We didn't feel elated about the whole thing at all. We were actually, I think, all suddenly thinking, gosh, this is what it would feel like for real. The only thing you feel as each missile goes is the submarine shudders. It's rather like an earthquake, or how I imagine an earthquake is. It goes like that, and it shudder, 15 seconds later, shudder, 15 seconds later, shudder, 15 seconds for 16 shudders in a row. It's quite a extraordinary sensation. And we were thinking, I think, all of us, golly, this is what it would be like, and this is probably the only time we'll ever get that sense of what it would be like.
Now, as in Polaris days, the Royal Navy's role in the firing chain begins in a bunker at Northwood, under the Chilterns.
It's known as the hole, and I'm descending into it through its heavily protected perimeter. We're just going through the first of the huge doors into a kind of airlock. We're now coming to where the Royal Marines are guarding the final entrance into the bunker. We're here entering the operations room. How do you do?
Hello, Peter. Commander Mark Honorati, known as H.
Very good to see you. Now, this is the room from which the command and control of the British nuclear deterrent is exercised.
Yes, this is Task Force 345's operations room, and I must first apologise if it doesn't look like some sort of underground bunker of the sort of James Bond era that you might be expecting. Unfortunately, there's no grey man in the corner sat there stroking a cat. It is a quite bland room.
But you're known as H, which has a faintly James Bond whiff about it, doesn't it, Commander?
Yes, but it's a name I've grown with since I've joined the Navy because the surname Honorati has always been too hard for some people to pronounce or spell.
Can you tell me what's going on here?
At the moment, we have two people who remain on watch here 24 hours a day, and their job is to pass on general information to the SSBN that's at sea on patrol. Their also primary job is that should we get the nuclear firing message sent to us by the Prime Minister, it's their job to ensure that that message is encoded and passed correctly to the submarine within the timescale directed.
We're about to have a demonstration of this crucial element in the firing chain, which starts with the Prime Minister and ends with the Trident submarine somewhere in the North Atlantic. And we're going to hear the message coming through from the government emergency room, which is part of the big bunker somewhere beneath the Ministry of Defence, from the two Cabinet Office authenticators.
Prime Minister's directive received. Stand by to authenticate.
Ready.
Alpha 940 Charlie.
Prime Minister's directive authenticates. Your reply is Alpha X-ray 5 Bravo Delta.
Concur. Prime Minister's directive authenticates. Stand by to submit the National Fire Control message.
Commander H, we've just heard the drill. What happens when the Prime Minister's directive comes through to here? What happens now that they've authenticated it and the national firing message is going to be passed out to the submarine? Does somebody in this room send the signal?
The message is put onto the system by an individual here, and then it's authenticated again on the system by the A-list and B-list officers, who have a certain time scale in which to put their message into the system to make sure it then goes onto the broadcast and is automatically transmitted to the SSBN at sea.
We're looking across to the safes, where the two separate safes where the codes are for the two authenticators. Is fail-safe built into this? What happens if somebody went balmy or somebody hostile somehow was in here? Are those absolutely secure, those safes?
The whole system has an assurance policy to ensure that, first of all, if we needed to get the message through, it will get through. So there is redundancy built into our transmission system under stress to make sure that the captain will receive the message if required. Also built into the system is an assurance that no one person could send a message to the submarine directing the captain to fire unless it has been properly authenticated. Within the CTF 345 ops room, as well as the two combinations on the safe, which the A and B listed officers only have the combinations to themselves, there's also a 24-hour watch kept on those safes via closed-circuit television by armed Royal Marines or Guard Service. If they see anybody who is unauthorised tampering with those safes, they will set off an alarm and they will enter this room with weapons ready to prevent them trying to gain access or interfere with the firing codes.
There is, of course, another possibility, in addition to the one I discussed with Commander H in the Northwood bunker, that it too had been wrecked by a surprise nuclear strike before any message could be transmitted to the submarine on patrol. If that were to happen, the commander of the boat, having established for certain that Britain had been substantially destroyed, has orders to go into the safe, secured to the floor of the control room, with his executive officer to retrieve the Prime Minister's last resort letter. I went aboard HMS Vanguard before it went on patrol to meet its captain, Commander Richard Lindsay.
Commander, you are now at sea, and to your certain knowledge, the United Kingdom has been the victim of a nuclear attack, a very serious one. You've done all the checks, including the Today programme, Radio 4 and all the rest of it. You know Britain is not there. You've got to go to the mode, the last line of defence, literally the last line of British defence. From beyond the grave, the Prime Minister's wishes are conveyed to you in a letter that's just a few inches from my finger in the inner safe of this grey safe standing in front of us here. What do you do in those circumstances?
In those circumstances, for me, we just go straight into our standard training profile. We will have had access through the outer safe. I would go into the inner safe, open the letter and conduct the instruction as per that letter.
Without question?
Without question.
But it isn't in fact the submarine captain who would pull the final trigger. It's the job of the weapons engineering officer known as the WEO, with whom I lunched on the all-male boat. The Navy says for health reasons, women can't become submariners.
We're lunching in the wardroom of HMS Vanguard with, counting up the number of officers, about 10 officers around the table. Remarkably good use of space. People have said that boats like this are the largest caravans in the world, that no bit of space is not used to maximum purpose, and you certainly feel that sitting around a dining table like this. Could you identify yourself for me?
Lieutenant Commander Mitch Puxley, I'm the weapons engineering officer.
In the event, which heaven forbid should ever happen, of it being for real, however many times you've exercised it, have you actually thought about what it would be like if it suddenly was for real, despite your hyper-familiarity with the whole business?
To actually conduct a strategic launch, what we'd be expecting is a major ramp-up in the political situation within effectively the planet. And what we'd be looking for is not a bolt from the blue firing drill telling us to carry out a strategic launch, but the whole world situation developing to such an extent that should we be conducting a strategic launch, that we would feel fully justified in actually taking part in that process, because we'd be expecting our homes and families to not be there when we get back.
Commander Richard Lindsay, you're the captain of the boat. Now, human beings change at all stages in their lives, and they can change quite dramatically sometimes. Does it ever happen that people acquire doubts about all of this, even though they've been in the business for quite a long time? And if it does, what happens? How do you look after them?
I'm sure that if somebody was on board who did not want to be here, they would have followed a process of leaving either the submarine service or finding something else to do within the Navy. For the people that have just joined, clearly they have to experience it. And on completion of the first patrol, they'll have experienced that. They can then make a decision as to whether they want to continue to pursue that or not.
Does it happen very often, somebody getting doubts?
The doubt might not be placed just purely on the deterrent. The doubt can be placed in terms of the personal commitment by being away from home, you know, the nil communication process that my team are going to experience now. And out of the armed forces, there are only going to be approximately 160 people who have no communication in any shape or form with their families.
Very few people in history have held anything remotely like that level of responsibility. Once you have, whether as Prime Minister, alternate ministerial decision taker, Chief of the Defence Staff, Bomber Controller at High Wycombe, V-Bomber Crewman, Commander in the Northwood Bunker, Submariner on Polaris or Trident, or Commander Richard Lindsay and Lieutenant Commander Mitch Puxley out there on Vanguard as you hear this programme. I think you're changed forever. And you should be. No wonder Tony Blair went quite quiet when Lord Guthrie first briefed him. If it were to happen for real in the future, the end of the firing chain would sound like this. It's never been heard publicly before. This is, I repeat, an exercise. You'll hear the order to bring the boat up from the depths to its hover position, still submerged, before firing.
Hover, command. Commence hovering.
Commence hovering.
Hands off.
Hands off.
Stop engine.
Stop engine.
Ship control in condition 1SQ.
In condition 1SQ, roger.
We're in the missile control centre. Clocks?
Check.
Standby RT.
Check.
Small ready handover.
Target package has been shifted. We're on the active target package. Gained access to the safes. Missile spinning up.
Roger. I have the system.
Listen now for the click as the weapons engineering officer pulls the trigger on the Colt 45 pistol handle with the wire running from its butt. Once you hear one away, the first missile is gone. And were it for real, that would be the sound of the end of the world.
We are fire control. Fire control in condition 1SQ for strategic launch.
Fire control in condition 1SQ for strategic launch. Supervisor Weir, roger. Command Weir, weapon system in condition 1SQ for strategic launch.
The Weir has my permission to fire.
Supervisor Weir, initiate fire one. One away.